It's 1996, the first Sunday of 1996. Couldn't hardly wait for it to get here. I preach 7 messages every year, whether you need them or not. This is the 21st year now. That means I can preach them again. I don't preach messages. If what I say doesn't send you out of here with something you can apply to your life, then I failed, and it's a waste from this point on. And today, again, I speak not to people without faith, but to those that have it. If you've got questions about your faith, come back on Easter Sunday. Because you know I lost my faith, came back through hard study, and I present the basis for that faith on Easter Sunday. But today, as we start 1996, I'm going to pick one of the 7 messages that is in print. You got it back there in the foyer, probably, in a pulpit magazine. But it's not just a sermon. It's a lifestyle. Whatever else you might say about the Hebrew Christian faith, God's very personal. It starts out with God talking to Adam and Eve in the garden until they messed it up. Then He occasionally established a relationship with people like Abraham that He called His friend, or Moses that after 40 years and lost in the wilderness, when that bush began to talk to him. As I said last Sunday, he didn't say, "Hey, shepherd," or "Hey, you over there." He said, "Moses." He knew exactly where he was, what he was doing, what his name was. And when Jesus moves on the scene, the fundamental claim of the Christian church is not all this other garbage you hear. It's that God moved into a tent of human flesh called Jesus of Nazareth and walked around in ordinary streets and brought God's life where ordinary people live. Religious people didn't like Him. He was a friend of sinners. And it was the religious people that brought about His execution. But the common people loved Him because He said, "When you've seen Me, you've seen the Father." And He taught us to relate to God with a prayer that says, "Our Father, who art in heaven." When I settled my faith, I remember the day I laid the last book down and said, "He came out of that tomb. There's no other explanation. Molecular displacements, no problem with the One who spoke and nothing became everything. Now what am I going to do about this reality?" He promised He would never leave me nor forsake me. And I remember I was sitting in a cannery in Oroville as a state inspector. That's why I hate bureaucrats. I was one. Believe it or not. And it was a wonderful job, like most bureaucratic jobs. I only had to work 5 minutes out of every hour. I had 55 minutes to do what I wanted to do, and I spent those years cementing my faith. I sat in an old rickety rocking chair. I laid the last book down, and I said, "Well, He said He'd never leave me nor forsake me. So I'd better start ordering my life as though I have this invisible audience with me." Now, as a preacher's kid, I had an audience. I couldn't do anything without somebody pecking at me. But suddenly this other presence became more important than all those others. I told you, I even bought an alarm watch to set it to go off every 30 minutes. So I would stop in my tracks and fix my mind on the fact there was this other invisible presence. This is the characteristic of all the great men throughout the Bible, the kinds of things you don't hear much about. Most preaching is talking, do this, don't do that, and all that other garbage that God doesn't really care much about. Remember I taught you on Elijah. And Jesus paid the compliment that no person was greater than Elijah. You study Elijah's life, he did things that modern preachers can't get away with. God sent him to live with a widow on the backside of the desert where nobody was watching. It's sort of an interesting line when she got upset at him. Remember, she said, "You've come to remind me of my past sins." That'll hit you about 6 o'clock today as you think about it. But everywhere that Elijah went, if you study that great man's life in the Old Testament, when he showed up, people thought about God. When he gets to where the widow is, she says, "As the Lord God of Israel liveth." That wonderful creed. She had passed the test in Sunday school. She knew God when she stopped to think about it. She knew God existed. When he encountered Obadiah, supposed to be a prophet, Obadiah says, "As the Lord God of Israel liveth." Every time Elijah came on the scene, people thought about God. And their thoughts were right. Their creed was accurate. Elijah had another dimension. Every time that he speaks on the subject, the phrase is added, "As the Lord God of Israel liveth, in whose presence I stand." He expanded the envelope of his consciousness to constant awareness of God's presence. That's what the resurrection is supposed to teach the Christian. A living person with us all the time. Not a resident policeman on our shoulder. He covered all that. Christ died for my sins. The law is dead. He's looking for someone who will trust him. And trust starts with awareness of his presence. I've told you the theologian that used to go out and lean on the fence and pray with his eyes closed. And I sort of mocked the way most people pray, saying I'd like to have a C&I dog franchise in heaven. If you can only talk to God with your eyes closed, they're going to be stumbling around heaven. So give me the C&I dog franchise so I can keep making money when I get up there. Give them a dog to lead them over to God so they can talk to Him with their eyes closed. Well, this old saint leaning on the fence said, "Why am I doing this?" And he opened his eyes and ever after prayed with his eyes wide open, looking out there at God. You know, most people close their eyes because if God happened to appear and they saw Him, they'd scare the liver out of them. Just keep their eyes closed. We have a lot of traditions that are silly. God's abstract and unreal and far out, and we go to church on Sunday and put a set of gears on and act spiritual. And spirituality is woo. Supernatural literally means more natural. The most natural person that ever lived was God encamped in human flesh called Jesus of Nazareth. Another old saint used to pray, sat a rocking chair down in front of him, and talked to God as though God were sitting in that chair. All of this is but illustration of the truth that must subsist under what I'm going to teach today, that God is a living, a very real and living person, the difference being invisible, not seen, except by the spiritual eye of faith, but nonetheless real. And it's that personal God and a faith that He exists in the fog of all of our problems as we start 1996, that makes me go to Psalm 37 and take this truth that every year I have taught at least once. And I think there are lots of things I'm sure you surpass me in, but I don't really think any of you are any smarter than I am. I wish my critics, as Willie Brown said when I listened to him, he got the Man of the Year award. He said, all the people writing lies about him, he wished they'd tell the truth. And he had just referred to an article in Time magazine talking about Slick Willie. He said, I wish they'd tell the truth. And I hope Willie's listening today, and I'm sure glad he's mayor of San Francisco. Willie said, Slick Willie, why don't they tell the truth about me? I'm just smart. Well, not sure I'm as smart as Willie, but I think I'm about as smart as anybody that's out here today. I ain't some spiritual nut running around. I've come to know that God exists. He spoke to us through His Word, and that He's very real. And I got a choice in the fog of my experience of whether or not I'm going to reach up through that fog, believe what He said, and hang my body on it. And if you can do that, then this message will be a success when I finish. And since I've said I don't think you're any smarter than I am, I've preached this message at least 20 times, and I'm sure before I ever came here a few times, and I still need it. And if I'm as smart as you and I still need it, then you need it. And if you're too dumb to know you need it, get up in the middle of it and walk out. Because I want smart people to hear the whole thing. Psalm 37 starts out with three times. And when God speaks more than once on a subject, He's got enough to say, I pay attention. If He repeats Himself, it must be important. Fret not. Fret not. Three times He says it. You got your Bible open to Psalm 37? Your Bible have Him say it three times or not? Fret not! We got any not fretters here? Anybody out here that doesn't fret? I want to meet one. I fretted all day yesterday, knowing I was going to probably get on this subject. Come on, you're getting here. Fret not. Fret not. Okay. How in the hell do you stop? That's what this chapter is about. Fret not, verse 1. Fret not, verse 7. Fret not. And by the way, this 8th verse really hit me right smack in the face. There may be one or two people here that are close enough to me, they know I got upset about something this past week. A rare thing for me. And this verse, the third time he says it, cease from anger and forsake wrath. I wanted to kill somebody all day yesterday. So that ought to tell you how bad I need this message. In fact, I've decided even if you don't need it, I'm going to preach it anyway. So I need it. Cease from anger and forsake wrath. Fret not. Three times. Now, you've heard me on this subject before. God always goes beyond what He asks us to do. How do you move from fret not to the end of the chapter, which says, and then I'm in between. Go to the end of the chapter. Verse 37. For the end of that man is peace. From fret not to the end, peace. And in between is God's formula. If you believe Him at all, and you apply His Word, and you understand faith is hanging your body on what God says, you can move, and so can I, from fretting, whatever it is. And I'll quit being humorous. I really believe that this is an age of anxiety. I don't meet very many people that don't tell me, oh, thank God we made it through the year, but it's been a terrible year. How many of you, if we could bear your soul open today, are full of fretting? Because of pressure, you don't even know why. I had someone tell me this past week that they didn't even know why. They would just break out crying. Pressure's on every side. And I want to know, I have a target other than myself for this message today. How many know what I'm talking about? You're fretting. About tomorrow, about this, about that. In a pressure cooker. Well, God gives a formula. And we have to do one, two, three things. I'm going to shorten it this time. We do three things that we can do. The reason I hate most preachers is they tell me to do things I can't do. Starting with being perfect. And then ending with quit sinning. Any of you that think you can be perfect, you're in the wrong church. Have I got any here? So we can throw them out. Any of you think you can quit sinning? You know that famous song, I once was lost in sin, now I am again. Whoopee! How many sinners are here? I came to the right church. We have to do three things we can do, not that stuff that you can't do, the Jimmy Swaggart message. I've told you 1,000 times, his sin was not the motel, that was bad taste. His sin was the mask of hypocrisy he wore, preaching a perfectionism he couldn't live. Neither could anybody else. The Pharisee message. We don't preach that kind of junk. But what I'm going to tell you, the three things that we have to do to move out of a fretting condition, you can do. There are three things man can do, and God will do the rest. I'll get to the good news in God's part in a minute. What are the three things? Commit, verse 5, commit thy way unto the Lord. The Hebrew is interesting. It's a word out of the camel train activity. When a burden bearer, the camel would kneel down, and a burden bearer would carry his burden over and lean over and roll off the burden onto the camel. Now what this verse says is so simple we want to ignore it. Commit thy way unto the Lord. Roll it over on to the Lord. Now I want to be eminently practical as I preach this, because God's part gets rather glorious as we get to it. commit thy way. Last year, I preached this message in the agony of a problem that every day brought me to the verge of writing a simple little note, giving everything I had to this church, and catching a plane one way to Australia. I preached this message out of the agony of a problem that was enveloping me that I felt would hurt this church, and that's what bothered me. I didn't care what happened to me. I didn't see any way out at all. And I remember as I stood here and preached it, I said, for 19 years I've preached this message to you because I thought you needed it. And though I needed it in part, I never ever realized that after this many years of pastoring and teaching, I would need this message more than anybody in this congregation. And I remember as I studied for it, I told you that at 5:30 that morning, I had done what this verse says. I had decided there was no way out of my problem. So I was going to do what it said. Roll it off on the Lord. Now, I never complicate spiritual things. I told you, Jesus said, pray in secret. So that's why we don't do a lot of praying here in the church. Don't be on the street corner praying like the Pharisees to be seen of men. I can't think of a street corner more prominent than worldwide television. So we don't pray. Jesus said, go to a closet and do it. But like I've said, I'm pretty realistic. I set God down in front of me, or imagine He's there, as that old theologian did. At 5:30 in the morning, almost a year ago, about 8 months, I remember at 5:30 in the morning, I didn't give you as many details then because I still wasn't sure God would take me through it. But I had gotten out of my bed and sat on the floor. I got a sort of strange chair in my bedroom, and I looked over at it. Figured God could have that chair, massaging chair. So I figured, put God in that chair. If He's not awake, that'll... I want you to think about God in more realistic terms. In the Old Testament, they had different ways of going to God, and it was complicated. The New Testament has a simple formula for invoking or activating any of these promises. It says we are not to think, in Romans 10, we're not to think that we have to go up there and get Him and bring Him down, or descend into the depths and bring Him up. He's already nigh you. And the words in your mouth speak it forth. For with the heart man believeth, and here is the verse taken out of context for those people that are out there trying to hang scalps on their belt and convert you to Jesus. They all know this verse, but not what went before. Let me repeat it. We're not to think we have to go up and get Him and bring Him down, or descend into the depths and bring Him up. The word's already nigh us. It's in our mouth. Speak it forth. For with the heart man believeth, and with the mouth, the King James says, confession is made unto salvation, but the literal Greek is, with the mouth, proclamation is made. One of the epistle writers says the tongue is the hardest member of the body to control. It's like the bridle of a horse. If we control the tongue, we can control the body. Out of the abundance of the heart, the mouth speaketh, but the reverse is also true. We say something long enough, we tend to become what we say, and we defend what we say because we said it more than we would if we hadn't said it. And the tongue becomes the bridle steering our whole being. God chose to make the activation of His promises in the New Testament that simple. We don't go somewhere to get Him. Don't go hunt Oral Roberts, lay hands on you. Don't descend into the depths. Channel 40. get some beehive to smile at you. You can do it yourself. With the heart man believeth, with the mouth proclamation is made as you hang your body on it. Therefore, how do you roll your problems off on God? You roll them up in a bundle of words, starting with the heart belief, which I still remember falteringly at 5:30 in the morning. I sat there on the floor and God was shaking in the massage chair. And I said, "Here, Lord, I can't even blame you for this mess. I caused it. I chose her." I told you this, you know, some of you want to blame God for your companions. You married the bitch. You fell sucker to the old goat's line. Do what you can with your mess. But I'm the only clergyman in the world who tells you a good divorce is better than a bad marriage. Just throw the old broad or the old guy out if you can't walk together and be agreed. So I didn't blame God for my problem. But I knew that I couldn't solve it. So, unlike Laurel and Hardy, where the old fat guy would say, "Listen, look at this, another mess you've gotten us into." I said, "Look, God, another mess I've gotten us into. But here, in a torrent of words, I'm going to act on this message before I go preach it, and I'm rolling it up in words, and if you can't describe, because your problem's so big it'd take for the next 3 days, just say, this whole mess." Literally, I'm telling you, if you believe in God and He's with you, roll your problem up in a bundle of words and say, "Here, I'm turning it over to you. My way." That's what's hard. "Here, God, take the problem and solve it and let me keep going with my way." You remember those guys on the east shore of Galilee? They had a demon-possessed guy scaring the Scabala out of them. And Jesus came along and cast the demons out of this guy. And the demons pled with Jesus that they not be sent to the abyss. Could they please go in the pigs? And Jesus said, "Yeah," and the demons went in the pigs. The pigs wouldn't tolerate the demons. They ran off the bluff into the Sea of Galilee and drowned. I can just see the poor fish scurrying from the demons then. And they got mad at Jesus. And I wrote a little book, it's up there. Our tendency to go to God and say, "Oh Lord, deliver me from my problem," symbolized with a demoniac. "But let me keep my pigs. Don't take the pigs with them. My way." At 5:30, about 8 months ago in the morning, and I told you when I preached the message, I'd done it, but I didn't know that God would take me through it. I can preach today. He took me through it. But I had to turn my way over to Him. Our way. That means a new controller. A new boss. Hey, I don't make big deals out of this. I don't worry about God's will. If you say to God you want Him to lead you, He's in control. It's harder to get out of His will than it is to be in it. But when you make that kind of commitment, you pause before you take new steps long enough to just see if He's going to speak. Now, my dad had visions, as I've told you. I didn't. God doesn't speak to me. Some of these Christians run around, they get a word from the Lord, and they go buy toilet paper at 7-Eleven. Every time a bird chips, church, God's talking to them. Clean your ears out. I said every time a bird chips, I misspoke. I meant to say chirps. But I didn't say what you thought I said. Though they probably would think that was a word from the Lord too. I'm just saying, when you commit your way to the Lord, you roll it up. I don't know what your problems are. I know mine. Got a new one, made me mad yesterday. But before I got here today, I did it again, but my problem's not as serious as it was 8 months ago. You roll it up, you say, "Here, Lord, take my way. Take it all. You work it out." Then the second thing, after commit thy way unto the Lord, rest in the Lord. He created the world in 7 days. And I commit my way to Him on Sunday morning at 5:30. He ought to have it solved by 7 p.m. God, isn't He? Why does God take so long to work it out? Rest. That's the part I hate. The committing, I do that because I'm desperate. But rest. That ain't my nature. I want it done by sundown. Rest. And then the third thing. That's even worse. Am I boring you? Wait patiently. Why? Wait patiently. And you know what that word literally is? Enduringly. Endure a little waiting. If God knew how hard it was for me to commit my way to Him, He wouldn't make me wait around unless I changed my mind. Because I know what commitment means. He gets to choose. Now, I got my own solution. I just don't have the power to do it. So when I commit to Him, I expect Him to do it my way. Fast, with no resting and no patient waiting. Sorry, that's a formula. Let me get to God's part and bring this to an end. Notice something in that fifth verse. Read it aloud with me if you got it open. Commit thy way. Come on. Commit thy way unto the Lord. Trust also in Him, which means lean on Him. And He shall bring it to pass. Is that what it says? Just one phrase in the Hebrew. It's not what it's translated here. What the Hebrew says, the Lord worketh. I want you to think about that for a minute. As soon as you make the commitment, hey, I happen to believe this. Hope I can bring you to it. As soon as I make the commitment, before I start resting and this irritating patient waiting, the minute I make the commitment, the Lord starts working. Now, if I don't get anything else across, I hope I get this across. I didn't see much going on at 11 o'clock, 11:30, 12 o'clock, after the service was over, 2 o'clock, 3 o'clock. I came and preached a message 8 months ago. At 5:30, to God shaking in that chair, I committed it to Him. Which meant I laid aside all of my solutions and said, And we know when we're going out of the gut. I said, God, I'm out of ability to solve this. And I really give it to you. I messed it up, but here. If your word is true, and if you can find forgiveness for me, take it and work it out. As I went through breakfast, drove to the cathedral, went through the service, preaching the message, having known in my heart of hearts I'd committed, God was already working. He is the Lord of hosts. That name, Lord of hosts, means that He can move inanimate objects. The stars fought in the heavens against Sisera in the days of Deborah and Barak. The sun stopped for Joshua. The Red Sea parted for Moses. He has control over everything. He controls angelic powers. Good God of mercy, one of them killed 180,000 of Sennacherib's army in one night. The devil can't go beyond the hedge he built. The book of Job tells us that. He even has Satan and his minions on a leash. He can move heathen forces. He can break the heart of a banker. He can blind the ways of a bitch. He can make a fool of that other word. He can make your enemies flee as though they have hornets on them. He's the Lord of hosts. We spend years tangling up our life and we commit it to Him, or we spend however long creating a problem with our own rebellious ways. The minute we committed to Him, like the father and the prodigal son, the minute the son is going home, the father runs to kiss him. The minute we make that commitment, God's grace, that's why I almost cry every time they sing that wonderful song, Amazing Grace. I tell you again, a slave peddler, peddling in human flesh in a storm on the sea off the coast of Africa, crying out for mercy, God heard him. And God forgave him. That's why he could pen the song that saved a wretch like me. He knew his condition. God's grace is such that in God will the church quit peddling this judgmental condemnation policeman God and peddle the truth of God's grace who gave His Son for us, that the minute we commit, He starts to work. With all of His power, He goes at it the minute you roll it off on Him. You can whisper that prayer as I'm speaking. And your problems you left at home, He goes to work. How? Not only does He go to work, the Lord knoweth. He goes to work with knowledge. Verse 18. The Lord knoweth the days of the upright. Their inheritance shall be forever. He goes to work with knowledge. God, I hope this is engraved in your mind today. He not only goes to work the minute I make a commitment, He goes to work with knowledge. I never tire of quoting Psalm 139. I forget it. The reason I quote it is to remind me. We get in a position where we think, nobody really knows my problem. I can't even tell it to someone. No one understands. And then what's worse, we keep trying to anticipate if our problem involves enemies, what are they going to do? What's their next move? Where are they going to attack? Hey, the Lord knows. I've committed my way to one who's working with knowledge. He knows what the enemy's going to do. He knows the pitfalls ahead of him. I preach the message at least once a year on the God of the forefront is our refuge, who gets on the corner before we get there. And I have to quote it to myself just about every day. Lord, Thou knowest my down sittings. Nobody else seems to know, Merle, but Thou knowest. God knows my down sittings. I listen to some of these religious programs. They never have any down sittings. God knows my down sittings and mine uprisings. Thou understandest my thoughts afore off. Thou compassest my path. The Hebrew is draws a circle around my path like a spotlight following someone across the stage. He really does. No. Thou compassest my path and my lying down. If I take the wings of the morning and dwell in the uttermost part of the sea, even there shall thy hand lead me, thy right hand shall hold me. If I make my bed in hell, thou art there. Wherever and whatever, he knows. And when you commit your problem to him, I want to push the mind to include this extra presence. You roll it off to him. He goes to work. And he knows. He does it with knowledge. He's ahead of the problem. He knows what I face that's given me anxiety. What's the third thing? The steps of a good man, verse 23, are ordered. The Lord ordereth. You know, a lot of you listening to me around the world today, and we're live on every square inch of this globe, and a lot of you sitting here, a lot of you watching at home on television, you may think you just channel surfed. I know it's been difficult, Merle, for you to get here. We've been trying for a long time. The Lord just couldn't know what the right Sunday is for you to be here. You and I knew it should have been weeks ago. Lord couldn't know. It's so hard when we commit our way to the Lord to rest and wait patiently in the knowledge that He's working on it with knowledge and ordering our steps. I mean, I've given my way to the Lord, but let's analogize to a post office. I give my letter to the post office. That has to be the damnedest inefficient operation the world's ever seen. Christmas time really reveals it. I'll be getting presents next June. But I go to the post office. And I drop world-shaking things in the mail. Valuable things. Sending this to Kentucky. Paychecks. It's going to get there. I don't go down to the post office and hang out there in the box with my arm down through the slot. You drive up, what are you doing, Gene? Well, I'm not too sure that the post office is going to carry this. I hear there's a storm in Kentucky, and I'm not too sure the post office is going to carry this the way I want it to go. Or I'm mailing something to New York, and I'm standing out there beating on the window, terrorizing this little civil servant behind the desk. I want to know which way you're carrying the mail. You're going to go via Denver or Dallas? Ludicrous, isn't it? We turn it over to the post office. Drop it in the mail. Get back in our car. Drive down the road. Somebody calls and says, you didn't pay that bill. Well, I mailed it. God, the post office is to blame. You got the point? I commit it to the Lord. And tomorrow morning, something happens that opens the door to me. It doesn't look like the way out of my problem. Well, of course, the devil has the ability to throw decoys along. If the Lord be Lord, if God be God, and you commit your way to Him, He's not going to let the devil open the first door for you. You understand? I preached this last year about this time, remember? Not this time, I preached it much later in the year, about 8 months ago. And I said to you then what I'm saying now. It involves trust. If you commit your way to the Lord, then by cracky, He better not let the devil open a door for me, because the next damn door that opens up, I'm going through it like a tornado. I've learned that in 20 years. When I commit my way to the Lord, whatever He opens up, that's the way I'm going. Because my promise says, the Lord worketh with knowledge and the Lord ordereth the steps. I've listened to preachers all of my life create anxiety by making people worry about the perfect will of God, the permissible will of God, some other crazy will of God, and how to stay in the will of God. Try to get out of it if you want to be in it. God's not playing hide and seek. He didn't send His Son to die to seek and save that which is lost, to then hide from you the rest of your life. Too many of you need rockets going off, stars falling, angels fluttering, praying sounds out of the woodwork. Then I know it's God's will. No, you're having a nightmare. God's will is not that hard to find. You commit your way to Him, rest, and wait. He's going to lead you. The steps are going to be ordered. You are not listening to this message by accident. You are not here by some fluke. And if you are here with problems, fret not. Commit thy way. Roll it up in words and give it to the Lord. Then rest and wait patiently, because He goes to work on our mess with knowledge. And He ordereth the steps. When you make that commitment, if you've made it while you're sitting there, expect some way out of your problem to open up. And don't quiver in indecision when it happens. Go through it. I've been trying to do this for years. I've been trying to catch God messing up on His Word. I've told you this over and over. If I could find a document, find something that would erase the resurrection, man, I'm free. If Jesus didn't come out of that tomb, I don't need Christianity. If He did, He's alive and well. He's all powerful. His Word is more important to Him than it is to me. And I'm not going to catch Him turning His back on His Word and saying, oh, I forgot. He's faithful to His Word, and the minute I commit, He worketh with knowledge and orders my steps. Well, what if all that's happening and I still lose faith, lose heart, and shoop up? That'll hit you too. Verse 24. Though he fall, he shall not be utterly cast down, for the Lord upholdeth him with His hands. Now, this has been kind of heavy stuff. Let me draw it to a close and hope you'll walk out of here acting on it. All you got to do with your problem to stop fretting is open your mouth to God. We're too prone to bellyache to everybody else. Open your mouth to God. His Word is forever settled in heaven, and He's declared Himself without equivocation, commit thy way unto the Lord. Rest and wait patiently, and the Lord worketh. He's working right now if you've committed it. He's unraveling strands that shouldn't have been connected. He's out there dissolving some obstacles along the way. He's clearing a path. He's trying to solve our problem without totally destroying our freedom, which created the mess. And He's working with knowledge. He knows everything. Hey, if I didn't believe that, what kind of God are you serving? I've said for 20 years you're going to be a Christian, be one. Quit all this add-on insurance policy. Little as I can do, make sure if there is any truth to this, I'm on the right side over there. Live it. He works with knowledge. And He orders your steps. Your life may change. You've got all kinds of plans. You'll serve God if He'll help you be what you want to be. You'll serve God if He'll just go along with your way. He may change your direction. He may remake your future. He may choose different partners. He may eliminate some hangers-on. Elimination is as necessary to the health of the body as assimilation. Remember that. He may get rid of some clutter. And He will step by step. He doesn't order the leaps. He doesn't order the jumps. He orders the steps. One by one, as you keep your commitment, doors will open that He's opening. But you lose heart. He's too slow. I can't wait patiently. God's not fast enough. Or some whatever weakness intrudes in, and I'm back to my old failing state. Can't preach an 8-day message. Only lasts 6 days, but Saturday I'm ready to kill somebody. And I fall. That's the message of this church. Though he fall, he shall not utterly be cast down, for the Lord upholdeth him with his hand. I'll preach many times this year of God's grace. I'm sure I'll preach on the potter's house. In the Old Testament, when a pot was marred, they threw it in the potter's field. In the New Testament, the last reference to a potter's field in the Gospels, the 30 pieces of silver that was the price of Christ's death was used to buy a potter's field. It's not an accident to get the message across that the price of his death bought the field of rejects so that he can start over again to remake the broken vessel. I'll preach this year, a bruised reed shall he not break, piece of broken grass. Bruised but not broken, he won't break it. Smoking flax, he'll not quench. That wick on the edge of a Hebrew lamp, just a spark of life, only smoking, he won't put it out. I think I'll preach on the prodigal son again. When he came to his sanity and turned home, the father ran to kiss him and prepared a banquet. I'll preach, I'm sure, on the Song of Asher. Underneath are the everlasting arms. Underneath is a Hebrew word that means underneath bottomless. If you can think of bottomless, then try to stretch the mind below that. And God certainly has the power, if the fall is that far, to move His arms from wherever they are to catch you. But the promise is that underneath bottomless everlasting arms. If I don't get any message across to the world, I want this one across. We serve a loving, forgiving God. Anytime you fall and get up pointing in the right direction, He'll pick you up. Though he fall, he shall not utterly be cast down, for the Lord upholdeth him with his hands. Believe me, a sensitive conscience person, I understand. We have a lot harder time forgiving ourselves for our past mistakes than God does. God, help me to get the message across. Your problems and your fretting can dissolve if you learn to commit your way to God. He goes to work instantly, and He does it with knowledge, and He will order your steps, but being what we are, we find it hard to follow, and we get off the track, and we fall on our face. Get up and do it again. For though he fall, he shall not be utterly cast down. Oh, other Christians will push you a little further down. So-called friends will turn their back. But though he fall, he shall not utterly be cast down, for the Lord, that's who we deal with, upholdeth him with his hand. I thank God that in 1995, the Lord upheld me with his hand. The closer you get to God and the further down this journey, the less you really care about what other Christians think. And the closer you get to God, the more you're aware of your distance from where you are and where he truly is. But thanks be to God for the knowledge that equal to the understanding of your shortfallings and the guilt that accompanies it, by far the measure of His grace, unmerited favor, is there available to take. Wherever you are and whomever you may be, commit your way to Him. He'll work on it with knowledge and order your steps. But if you've stumbled, get up again, because the Lord upholdeth with His hand. And I'm closing again with the song. Come on up. Amazing grace. How sweet the sound that saved a wretch like me. 1996, I want you to know that well of His grace, mercy and forgiveness, and chance to start over again, wherever you are and whatever your condition, that well will never, ever run dry. And that's my message. I'll be looking at you all week.